Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Friend, beloved God.
Friend, beloved God.
Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
Babaji Krishna.
Babaji Krishna.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Lahiri Mahashaya.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Swami Sri Yukteswar.
Beloved Guru.
Beloved Guru.
Paramahansa Yoganandaji.
Paramahansa Yoganandaji.
Saints of all religions.
Saints of all religions.
We humbly bow to you all.
We humbly bow to you all.
O beloved Lord.
O beloved Lord.
Help us.
Help us.
To realize thee.
To realize thee.
And then through that realization.
And then through that realization.
To serve everyone.
To serve everyone.
Who are also thee.
Who are also thee.
Om.
Peace.
Amen.
Amen.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. It's such a joy to have so many people gathered together here from all different places, and we also are having live streaming through the internet. People are still coming, so if there's a chair next to you, why don't you raise your hand so people can see where there's chairs.
There are a few up here.
There's one center, front center. So in 1969, Swami Kriyananda gave us the model of Spiritual Renewal Week, which we've had every year since then in August. But then we began thinking, for those of us who want to go deeper on the spiritual path, why it would be nice to have something that really enables those of us who want to go deeper to be able to go deeper on the path. I think tomorrow we're going to ask people to get here on time because it's a little disruptive to have people coming in the middle. So we started in a renewal week, and in that, this is an opportunity for all of us to really explore more deeply the spiritual life, the spiritual path, how do we move forward individually. And so it's really for those who have made a serious life commitment to the spiritual path, and it's just always such a joy to have all of us gathered together with this deep sincerity and earnestness that enables all of us as a group of disciples of Master to move forward spiritually together. So I think we'll invite, I think we have some music, so we'll invite the singers to come up.
Those of you who have attended past Inner Renewal Weeks know that we have a tradition. Now that's more than just a showy start. There's a deep spiritual purpose to that too. In the Bhagavad Gita, you might remember that at the beginning of the battle, that the Pandavas blew conches, and the Pandavas are the representative of the chakras, and the sound of the chakras is represented by the conch, and it's the call for the devotee to go within and upward toward the leadership of Krishna that represents the spiritual eye. And so the blowing of the conch is here symbolic of us all going inward in Inner Renewal Week and toward our spiritual home in God, but also in our own self. This morning I'm going to talk, the theme of this morning is how to renew our motivation to find God. And one of the ways that we renew our motivation, there are really two really strong ways. One is by what we take in, and we need to take in sometimes new things. So read new books, or read a book that you have read before but with new attention. Perhaps watch a movie. But the things that, kind of the mental diet, sometimes if we just eat the same diet over and over and over again, we get into a rut and we mix things up. When we mix things up, we get some nourishment that we haven't had before. So that's one important way. The other important way to renew our motivation is by gathering together with other sincere devotees, which is, of course, as Devi said, the purpose of this week is to allow us to gather together in a large group like this. And not only the intermixing that we have, the classes that we have, but really, even more importantly, the magnetism of sincere devotees, all yearning for God, yearning for liberation, helps re-motivate us to find our own deeper motivation, which is there or we wouldn't be in the room today. I'm going to talk this morning mainly about things that have come from a new book that I've read. The book isn't actually new, but it's new to me. It was given to us when we were in India, and it's the first time I've read it. So it's the biography of Lahiri Mahashaya, and it's written by a man named Chatterjee, who is a longtime deep Kriyaban, but it's in collaboration with Lahiri's grandson and the son of one of the sons of Lahiri. And he had in his possession 26 of Lahiri's notebooks or journals that he kept throughout his whole life. And so together with Chatterjee and working with those notebooks, this book was produced. And I have found great, great inspiration from it. And I want to talk about some of that inspiration because it's renewed my motivation in certain ways. And I hope that by talking about it, it will help renew yours. Now, I can't say with absolute certainty I can't speak about the veracity of the book, because I don't know whether there's a mixture of the author, Chatterjee, and the writings of Lahiri. It's just presented. And so it's not like, here's a direct quote of Lahiri and here's my thoughts. It's all a little bit mingled together. But nonetheless, whether it's exact or not, and I think we should always take things, unless they are direct quotes, with a little bit of a grain of salt. Whether it's exact or not, it has been a very great motivator for me, because it's presented, at least for me, a kind of a fresh way of looking at the spiritual path. Now, one of the primary themes that runs throughout this book is that it equates God with prana. And so it talks about prana. We have a tendency in the West, because one, we don't know the deeper teachings by and large, and also we sometimes simplify things, to think of prana as, oh, that's just energy. And even if it's universal energy, yes, I draw it in. But we tend to think of it more or less as unconscious and available for our use. But in here, there's a very, very different picture of prana. Prana is equated with consciousness of God. And so there's a deep, intelligent vibration that is prana. And the primary, one of the primary themes in this book is that when prana rests in God, with God, it's in its still form. And so it's not moving. And that's God beyond creation. So we have to think, first of all, of the world before creation comes into being. And in that state, which we sometimes call the night of Brahma, there is only still prana. And as we have heard, that still prana has been defined by the Adi Shankara as being Sat Chit Ananda, meaning existence, consciousness, and bliss. The master added ever new bliss, so the concept of ever new. So it isn't static, it's vibrant, it's very, very energetic, but it has not yet gone into creation. And then God takes a small portion of that stillness. In here it says 1%. Now whether it's exactly 1% or not, I'm not going to say, but takes a small portion of that stillness and begins to vibrate that stillness. And that makes it active or dynamic, or the word kinetic is also used. So that vibration creates the universe. And it also, because the stillness is now vibrating, and a vibration has a polarity, it has a one side and another side. It's like the tongs on a tuning fork. If you strike it and it begins to vibrate, those tongs move to the left and to the right. And so they have those two poles, left and right. And that is the initial creation of duality. So the primal duality before anything else is the duality between still prana and dynamic prana. Now, dynamic prana we can call by a variety of names. One thing of calling it is Om, because Om is the vibration of that dynamism. Another way that we call it is Divine Mother. And we think of Heavenly Father as being beyond creation, Divine Mother as producing creation. Obviously, it's all one. And I get sometimes amused and sometimes exasperated by some people who take Divine Mother as if she is the only feminine principle or feminine thing, and it becomes a goddess, or it spins out. It's all one. It just is the expression of duality. And yes, of course, there's a masculine and feminine aspect to duality, but it isn't as if this creation belongs to the mother or something. It's all one. And so that vibration comes into being. So imagine stillness and then vibration. Another word for it is the word, or amen. In the Bible, it says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so it's talking about the beginning of creation comes from this setting into motion, the dynamic prana, and then the primordial duality is still prana. Now, if you take the concept of sat, existence, chit, awareness, and ananda, bliss, and you begin to bring those concepts into vibration or duality, then what happens is that in the created world, they seem to take on a dual nature. And so sat, existence, seems to take on the nature of existing and not existing, or as it implies to us, life and death. And so life, we're alive, and then we die, and probably at least a good portion, maybe the majority of the world, thinks that when we die from this body, we no longer exist. There's no life after death. There's no consciousness that goes on. There's nothing. My father was one of those. Toward the end of his life, we were, you know, we talked some philosophically, and he thought I was a little naive to think that consciousness or there was a soul or something existed after death. For him, death was the end of his existence, and that was it. And he represents the consciousness of a lot of people. But because there's the thought that there's no existence after this body goes, there's enormous insecurity and enormous anxiety and the attempt to prolong the life of this body. Some years ago, we attended a lecture by Danian Brinkley, who had had a near-death experience and experienced himself out of the body for some period of time. He was struck by lightning and his heart stopped, and he went through a near-death experience. And one of the things later on, he wrote a book, but later on, one of the things that he was working with was to essentially to help magnetize and energize the hospice movement, where people accepted the fact that they were going to die. And he quoted quite an astounding figure, and this was 20 years ago or 15 years ago at least. He said that the average American spends $100,000 to prolong their life for 30 days toward the end of their life. And in many cases, they use up their entire life savings and go into debt to hang on for an average of an extra 30 days. That was 20 years ago. It's probably at least double or more than that now. And so this enormous anxiety to hang on, it's just still prana expressing, it's still prana having the concept or the quality of existence expressing itself in its dual nature. And obviously, existence does not end with the end of this body. And so we know that well from our teaching, so I won't go on more. So sat, chit, chit is awareness. And in duality, we have awareness and unawareness, consciousness and unconsciousness. Many people see the world as having most of it being unconscious. Trees are unconscious, rocks are unconscious, clouds are unconscious. People, most of them are conscious. At least I'm conscious, but I'm not too sure about the rest, you know? And then you've got sleep and waking and all those dualistic forms of consciousness But having the sense that most of the existing world is not conscious allows us to treat it in ways that we would never treat something that we recognized as being conscious. And then finally, Ananda, when bliss comes into duality, that duality is happiness and sadness, or happiness and pain. And Master said that the primary motivation of everyone on the planet is to be happy or to avoid pain. He said everyone, and everything that we do is simply an expression of that primal motivation, which is really the attempt to get back to bliss, which can't happen until we still the pranic vibration, but we can approach it. And I want to, that's going to be mainly what I talk about. But so for this introductory aspect, just understand that all happiness and unhappiness is simply the vibrational aspect of bliss, moving between a polarity. Okay, so now we have the concept of still prana and dynamic or active prana. Now, it isn't just dynamic or active prana. It is increasingly faster rates of vibration. And the faster that rate of vibration, the farther away from stillness it is, the more real this world seems, and the less real the world of still vibration, or the world of pure spirit, or the spiritual world, or God. The farther away we get from that stillness, the more that seems like, at the most, a pleasant theory. And for many people, it seems like it doesn't even exist, that anything beyond this world exists, really. And so this vibrational rate of dynamic prana is very, very important, because the essence of the spiritual path, the essence of our spiritual search, is to move from restless dynamic prana to still prana. And our whole spiritual path is designed in order to help us do that. So I'll explain that in a little more detail. In this book, it talks about how each of the chakras has a different rate of vibration. And so visualize perfect stillness, which represents God beyond creation. That's represented by the thousand-petal lotus, the Sahasrahar. Now, Master in our teaching said that we can't go directly from stillness to, I mean, from dynamic, the dynamic aspect of prana to the still aspect of prana. We first have to go through the what he talks about as Christ consciousness. And so that's the interpretation of that passage in the Bible that fundamentalist Christians wave during football games, saying, "No man cometh unto the Father but by me." So that's a statement of Jesus. And their interpretation is, therefore, if you aren't a Christian, and a Christian of the nature that I am, not one of those other Christians, but my kind of a Christian, then you can't come on to the Father. You can't go into heaven. The real meaning of that is that first we have to achieve Christ consciousness. And Christ consciousness means the awareness of that still vibration, that 99% of reality, that still vibration is present in every atom of creation, in everything that there is. And when we realize the presence of God in every atom of creation, that's what that means to have Christ consciousness. Now, In India, it would be called Krishna consciousness, or the term is also used because the point in the body at which we achieve that is the point between the eyebrows, or the better term for it is the kutastha. That means that that point that's here, but point between the eyebrows could also be interpreted as being kind of the outer part or the brain or something. This is the spiritual center. It's actually the reflected or projected vibration of the Agya chakra. And so the kutastha is here, and in India, they call Christ consciousness kutastha chaitanya. Kutastha, I'm going to read the definition. I looked it up because I thought it's actually very interesting. Sanskrit word kutastha means that which remains unchanged. So that which remains unchanged is completely still. Chaitanya means consciousness. And so kutastha chaitanya is the awareness of the infinite nature of spirit inherent in all things. Well, when Master came over, instead of using that, he called it Christ consciousness. And so we're relatively familiar with that term, Christ consciousness. Now, Christ consciousness is here, and Master said that we have to achieve Christ consciousness here before a subtle channel opens up, and that subtle channel allows us to experience the vibration, this completely still vibration that is beyond creation. So first we have to experience God in creation, because we are in creation, before we can experience Him beyond creation. Now, the rate of vibration of the kutastha is between 1 and 9, according to this book. This is all according to this book, not from personal experience, and I've never calculated these kinds of things. I'm just passing on. But it's highly motivating to me. So if we understand that the stillness between 1 and 9 is still enough so that we perceive the vibration of God in everything, and then we can go to God beyond creation. Now, another way of looking at that is that another word that we use for the kutastha is the spiritual eye. Now, the spiritual eye is actually what we see at the kutastha. And the spiritual eye, as we know, is the golden ring with the deep blue field and the five-pointed star within it. Now, why do we see that at all, and why do we see it here? The reason is that that is the projection of the inner astral channel, or the Sushumna. And so the gold ring is the astral world, the blue field is the causal, and the white star is God beyond creation. And that is contained in our Sushumna. There are actually three channels in the Sushumna. And once we get our consciousness into the Sushumna, and we begin to project that, see it clearly at the kutastha, then our consciousness becomes still enough so that we can see that, that we go beyond the ego, because part of the duality is also our ego. And so we go into that stillness that is sufficient, even though it's still in creation, it's sufficient for us to see the presence of God everywhere. Another word for that is samadhi. Another word for that is breathlessness. Now, why breathlessness? Because when we're born, we start to breathe, and we breathe continuously until we die. And in between, there's never a time for very long that we are not breathing. Now, that's the physical breath, but the dynamic prana is actually represented in the ira and the pingala. So the astral breath, or the subtle breath, is the dynamic movement that comes in when we are born in the ira that corresponds with the inhalation and the pingala that corresponds with the exhalation. And so that movement is there continuously from birth until death, with one exception. And that is, if you go into samadhi or you go into breathlessness, you can remain conscious because you've withdrawn the energy from the ira and the pingala into the shushumna. You've gone into the spiritual eye, and that dynamism, if not completely stopped, has at least slowed down enough between 1 and 9 vibrations. Let's assume that it's per second. It doesn't say in here. But it's slowed down enough so that it's no longer actively dynamic. Then, as you come, so that's the spiritual eye and the Ajna chakra, which is at the top of the 6 chakras. Then as you come down to the Vishuddha chakra, the vibrational rate is 10. And that is not slow enough for you to, if the vibrational rate is still as restless as 10, you don't yet have stillness enough to perceive yourself completely as God. You can't go into samadhi. You can't release the ego yet. When it comes down to the anahat chakra, it's 10 times 10. It's 100. And when it comes down to the manipur chakra, it's 10 times 100 or 1,000, and then 10,000, and then 100,000 at the base of the spine. And so that increasing restlessness, the increasing vibrational rate of the dynamic prana draws us down and outside of ourselves. And as why outside of ourselves? Because Master said that the chakras function like projection booths. And so think of one image would be, think of a projection booth, and here it's a 10-watt bulb. Now that doesn't push you very far outside of yourself. Here it's a 100-watt bulb. That does more. But here, 1,000-watt, 10,000-watt, 100,000-watt bulb, that pushes you outside. And it makes not only the world seem real, but it attracts us to the world. Because along with this dynamic prana, the dynamic form of prana, I should say, automatically come restless thoughts, which are still consciousness in vibration, so it's thinking restlessly, and desire, like and dislike. That's another one of these polarities. So we cannot stop restless thoughts. We cannot stop desires simply by trying to say, go away, restless thoughts. Go away, desires. I had the image that kind of works for this. Well, let me come back and talk about, because it's hard to kind of conceive of what the scale is when you say 10 here and 100,000 there. Sometimes it's kind of hard to conceive. So I translated that kind of spatially. And so think of the energy having to go out and keep active a spatial relationship. So if we take the point here from 0 to 9, and I'm going to call that 5, Master said to visualize the spine as thick as your thumb. And so if we think of this about as thick as the thumb, then as we come here, it's 10, that's about as big as a ping pong ball. And when you come here, it's about as big as a serving platter. But it's still pretty well self-contained. When you come here to the Manipur chakra, it's about as big as the Lahiri temple. When you come to the sacral, it's about as big as if you take where we are now and go out to the parking lot beyond the boutique, where you enter and so on, the registration, and draw a circle around. So it's like the meadow, and with us in the center, it's a circle like that. And at 100,000, it's a circle as big as from the entrance at Tyler Foot Road past the market. And so you can see spatially that if you're trying to keep all that territory active, and that represents potential desires and potential thoughts and restless thoughts, you can't just you can't just say, oh, go away, I'm not interested in you quite so much anymore. Now, another image occurred between dynamic and restlessness and desires. We've got these ceiling fans here. Now imagine a big table, and you take two or three down pillows and you rip them open, you put all those feathers on the table. Now that represents restless thoughts and desires. Now what happens when those fans start turning? Well, here the fan turns once every 12 minutes. That's not going to ruffle those feathers enough to even make them move. You could barely even see it. Here it goes once every 6 minutes. Here it goes once every 30 seconds. Now, 30 seconds going around like that might be enough to ruffle some of those, but not very much. That's why Master and the great teachers try to get us and give us actual techniques to bring our energy into the upper three chakras, the upper triad, because they call this kind of the spiritual chakras and the lower chakras the more materialistic chakras. Now, none of them are really one or the other. We're just using this because we're equating stillness now with the consciousness, with our spiritual consciousness. And so at once every 3 seconds, it is still not stirred up too much. But now you're getting it going like, I don't know, I have to look at my notes because I actually did figure it out here. It down here, it's revolving 30 times a second. And lower down, it's 90 times a second. And then, this is at this chakra, it takes 30 seconds, so a half a minute. So it goes twice a second. Down here, it goes 3 revolutions a second, spinning it up, 9 revolutions a second, and then 90 revolutions a second. Imagine these fans going 90 revolutions a second, and you saying, I'm not going to want any of these feathers to move. It's evil if they move. If I have desires, I'm an evil person. I'm going to meditate, but I'm not going to turn the fans off while I meditate. And I'm going to tell my mind, be quiet. Don't have restless thoughts. It just does not and cannot work. And so what Lahiri says is that the only way this works is to pull the plug. The only way is to make that prana still and not dynamic. And so that is the teachings of our spiritual path. All of our spiritual path is based on pranayama, or control, or stilling still bringing that active, dynamic, restless prana into more and more stillness. And so when we sit to meditate, the key is not to try to suppress our thoughts or push down our desires. The key is to focus on stilling our prana. Now, where is prana still, or still enough? It's here. So our meditations should be focused on bringing our consciousness to this point and using the techniques that we have been given, which are You know, energization helps us become aware of prana. Hong Sa helps us become aware of prana and bring it to this point. Om helps us to bring the vibration under our conscious control. And Kriya withdraws the prana and brings it up here after Jyoti Mudra. And that's the summation of our path. Now, Lahiri basically said any other spiritual path is less effective than this. That's why in the autobiography of a yogi, it says that Kriya Yoga is the most effective technique for spiritual advancement by human endeavor ever given. Why? Because my religion is better than your religion? No. Because if we equate spiritual evolution with the stilling of prana, what is the way that's most effective to still prana? And that's the practice of Kriya Yoga and these pranayamic techniques. Now, Lahiri actually said that one of the reasons that he incarnated at this time in Dwapara Yuga, and remember, he came to Babaji. There's a beautiful drama here. So he came to Babaji after he was married, after he had children. He was relatively late. He had responsibilities, and he had a job for the British as a clerk. And essentially the aspect of the military that dealt with building roads and so on. And the reason that he was sent, when he was sent, the telegram arrived, was they were thinking of putting in a new road, the British, and he was supposed to go and help survey that. Then Babaji calls him, and remember in the autobiography, he says, Lahiri, don't you remember me? And Lahiri says, no. And then Babaji touches him on the chest, and he realizes that he's a long-time devotee of Babaji, reawakens that. He goes into samadhi for several days. And then Babaji, he says, oh, Babaji, I want to stay with you. I want to stay with you. And Babaji says, no. There's a reason that you have a family, you have a job, and I want you to go back and continue that family, continue that job, even though you're now an enlightened yogi. And so that's what he did. But the backstory is that he wanted to come in to the world at this time in order to be the channel through which Kriya was brought, because Kriya is such an effective and quick technique that even people with jobs and with responsibilities and with families can practice Kriya and find liberation. They don't have time to practice slower techniques. So he brought a really efficient technique into the world, and he incarnated in order to do so. And he had he was the highest yogi of his time. He had great saints, both householders and monastic, coming to him. He had many maharajas came and took initiation, but everything was very quiet. He didn't want to start an organization. He didn't want to start a big teaching. He forbid his students to propagate his name very much. An interesting story shows you how he was just seeding these things into the world, and very quietly. He had a nephew who, when the nephew was grown, he was 20, 21, something like that, contacted some disease. And he went to many doctors, and the doctors finally despaired and said, we can't cure it by medical means. You have to find a Mahatma who will bless you and who can cure this disease. And so the nephew started looking around, and through some people who suggested that there was a Mahatma that he could go, I think, up in Kashmir, and he could go and make the trip from Varanasi, from there, a long, long trip up to see a Mahatma. And some friend of the family's heard this, who was a disciple of Lahiri, and he said, "Are you crazy? Why are you wanting to make a long trip to go to a Mahatma when you have one in your own family? In fact, you have the greatest of them in your own family." And here's a grown nephew who didn't even know that. And so Lahiri did not broadcast a whole lot. He didn't advertise. There were no Lahiri flyers going out. He was just seeding this into the world. Okay, so what he was seeding is the concept and the techniques, especially of Kriya Yoga, that allow us to very quickly move toward bringing our restless, dynamic prana that otherwise goes down and out over that large territory and all those feathers flying around, all those desires, to begin to shut that down more and more, to close it down, and then to bring the energy up the spine to the kutasta, and hold it there. And Lahiri said that Kriya Yoga was cooking the food, looking into the light of the kutasta is eating the food. And so the whole of our path, in one sense, that's what's given me the motivation. Now, I'm going to talk more about this, these concepts as applied to meditation itself tomorrow. But the very concepts themselves, the understanding that it has to do completely with moving back to the 99% of what we are, which is still prana, from the dynamic state, has renewed my desire to do that. So when I sit to meditate, I'm not kind of confused about what my goal is. My goal is to still the prana and to get my focus as completely to the kutasta and hold it there as still as I can for as long as I can. And in that stillness, certain things begin to happen. So light begins to emerge. That's one reason there are a number of things that happen, and interpretations of the spiritual teachings that we know that can be reinterpreted in terms of holding your consciousness at the spiritual eye. And when you hold it there, when you become absorbed there, one of the things that happens is you see the spiritual eye, but you also see great light. It's called the, Master talked about it as light, more light than a million suns, and yet it is not harmful. It isn't like a bright light in the eyes. It's mellow, but it's enormously bright. And from that, you can reinterpret what's day to the yogi is night to the worldly man, and what's night to the yogi is day to the worldly man. The worldly man means the restless the restless energy, the dynamic prana, is going out, making this world outside of us seem to be the real world, when it isn't. To the yogi, who's in a state of still consciousness, then that stillness produces great light and great understanding. Another thing that in this book, it talks about some reinterpretations of common understanding that we have of the spiritual teachings. So probably all of us can name the paths of yoga, can't we? There's Jnana Yoga. There's Bhakti Yoga, there's Karma Yoga, there's Raja Yoga. And so we understand what that is and know pretty well. Well, we don't. In fact, what Lahiri said, because these yogas are taught in the Gita, he said what karma yoga is kriya yoga. Kriya means action. And so the practice of karma yoga is the practice of kriya. He reinterprets everything internally and in terms of our own state of consciousness. And so the practice of kriya is karma yoga. Bhakti yoga is that when the energy has been sufficiently internalized through the practice of karma yoga, kriya yoga, then the energy begins to awaken at the spiritual eye, and the heart naturally, the anahat chakra, naturally opens, and all of the love, energy, feelings that otherwise would go out through dynamic prana now are internalized and come up to still prana. And so the connection between the feeling nature and the stillness is devotion. That's true devotion. He basically says all the rest is not really devotion. It's an attempt to awaken and bring stillness in. And so what we think of as devotion, you know, offering to the guru and all of that, yes, that's important, but it's outwardly only a symbol of the real thing. This is the guru. And so offering the feelings to the guru internally, this is Christ consciousness, it's Krishna consciousness, it's Kutusta Chaitanya, and offering the feeling natures to that brings it into stillness. Or as Patanjali says, when the whirlpools of chitta here are neutralized, then we automatically go into a state of union with God, or yoga. Another way of saying that is when the dynamic prana of that is in our feeling nature, which Master called primordial feeling nature when he interpreted that, when that becomes stilled, we automatically realize our unity with God. See how everything now begins to tie together. The different, the Pandavas represent, as I've already said, the chakras, and Krishna represents the spiritual eye or the Kutusta. Why is Krishna driving a chariot? In the Gita, it says that the chariot, the field of battle is the body. And the chariot represents that field of battle and represents the body. And Krishna is sitting at the forepoint of that chariot. The forepoint of the body is here. And he's under control, under his control, are the five horses representing the senses. And so Krishna is here. Arjuna is behind him, being driven in the chariot. And Arjuna, the devotee, the disciple, the energy of wanting to be there, is being guided, directed, and driven by the guru. So that's true guru worship, bringing our energy here and uniting it with Krishna or Master, because Master had this state too. And so the true guru is not outside of us, it's inside of us. But the sat guru comes to give us the practices to remind us and also to bless us, motivate us in order to bring our energy there. And just a couple of other interesting things. So the Kauravas represent the chakras and the movement of dynamic prana being guided by Krishna. In other words, the Pandavas represent the chakras, and the dynamic energy in the prana in the chakras now being withdrawn and guided by Krishna, offered to Krishna, so offered into stillness. And so that's a directional inward and upward. The other direction is that prana enters here, and it's down and out, and that's represented by the Kauravas. And so King Material Desire is the one stepping up the speed of the fan so that all of those feathers get all out there, and isn't it exciting, and isn't it wonderful, and let's have some more desires, and let's have an infinite number of soldiers fighting on our side with desires and restlessness, an infinite number of those feathers out there. But so that's the battle of Kurukshetra. And the last thing is that I found very interesting in the interpretation was Drupadi. She represents Kundalini, because it's the Kundalini, or the dynamic prana, that is collected at the base of the spine. The Kundalini then in enlightenment comes into the Sushumna, up through the Sushumna, and unites here. But until the Kundalini comes up and unites in the Sushumna here, that Kundalini energy is working through the ear and the pingala. So those two channels which represent duality, Drupadi means two-footed. And so the interpretation is Drupadi also represents the ira and the pingala. And that keeps us in dynamic prana, keeps us from stilling the prana and from going into our unity with God. And so this, I've found this whole kind of new way of looking at it to be very, very motivating to my spiritual life and to my sadhana. And I'll just end by saying, you know, we've heard the famous story of Lahiri not wanting his picture taken. And we think, oh, he had a little quirk, you know, one of those people. Maybe you'll put it on a poster or something. I don't want it taken. And he used magical powers. He said the reason he didn't want his picture taken was he didn't want people worshiping him and forgetting to do their sadhana. He wanted them to do their sadhana, which is Kriya Yoga, and bringing the energy to the Kutasta and bringing it from dynamic outward restlessness into inner stillness and uniting with God. And we'll talk more about the actual meditational practice of it tomorrow.
Well, Jyotish was talking about the inner realities to motivate us to find God. And I'd like to talk a little bit now about the how and the why we can motivate ourselves. And Swamiji has said, and it's a little bit frightening, he has said that on the spiritual path, we don't tread water. You are either moving forward or you are moving backward. And that's a little daunting. But when I look at my own life and the lives of devotees that I know here, it's interesting because using the analogy of the Bhagavad Gita, which we're all familiar with, Master's interpretation and commentaries, Krishna draws Arjuna's chariot at the very beginning between the two armies, looking at what's in front of him. Essentially, what he's looking at is, what is the spiritual path before me? What does this battle entail? And he looks at the opposing army, which, according to Master's interpretation, is just aspects of our own self. And he says, this is too much. I can't fight. These are my relatives. These are part of myself. I can't fight them. And so he slumps in his chariot, means he leaves the posture of meditation. He drops his bow, meaning that the energy is no longer rising. And he says, I will not fight. Well, for most of us, myself and my guru bhais, very few of us, unless they really have a break with the spiritual path, say, I will not fight. We don't say, I give up. What we do say is, I let up, meaning I'm not going to try as hard. And that's what we need to look at. That's why we have this focus for Spiritual Renewal Week. How do we look at the process of letting up, and why do we do it? So first I'd like to talk a little bit about why we pull back from the spiritual path, why we kind of begin treading water, which as Swami says, we don't tread water, we're moving backwards. I, based on Master's teachings and what Swami has taught us, I could see several different reasons why we let up. First, fear of failure. What if I can't do this? What if I try really hard and I just don't get there? But then we need to remember the teachings of the Gita that say, there is no failure. However far we get, we pick it up in the next life. And if we're trying to get from A to Z, we're going to have to go through all those points at some point in time. We can either be satisfied with getting to point B, or we can say, you know, I'm going to try to get really as far as I can get. I remember in the very first winter I was here at Ananda, it was a time of spiritual and personal and emotional challenge for me, because I was really making a decision that we all make at some point. Do you really want to commit your life to the spiritual search? And I was challenged, my mother challenged me on every level. I didn't have an adequate place to live. I was in an unheated teepee. I didn't have a clear source of income. I really didn't know many people here. I was quite lonely. And the familial warmth, as Master says, when little Master's friend decided to leave off the search, the quest to the Himalayas, the familiar warmth started to pull me. And I thought, go back to family and friends and security. And yet, thank God, there was enough good karma, I would say, and the power of the guru on the other side that said, you know, you're going to come to this point again. Why not just see it through as far as you can go in this lifetime? And that was the choice I made. I want to remind you that Master, the divine guides, over and again, they bring those choices. They take us to the point of failure so we can ask ourselves, what do I really want? What if I fail? I'd rather, like the little frog and the big frog in the bucket of milk. I mean, it's a silly children's story, but very profound in the life of the devotee. I'd rather die trying. And so the fear of failure, we just need to say, maybe I won't get very far. Maybe with full blast, I'll get to point B. But nevertheless, I'm moving in that direction. So to look at fear of failure and say, I'll get as far as I can in this life, and it's not a competitive race. Maybe some people are way ahead of me, but karma is funny. And I've also seen people who seem to struggle and struggle and don't seem to be able to get their footing on the spiritual path. And yet, as Swami used the analogy, it's like a nail in a board. We don't know how much karma is hidden in that board. And then you see other people just seemingly. I remember in the first year of Ananda, there were people living here who were literally meditating 6 and 8 hours a day. None of them are here anymore. Because it was coming not from a point of offering their lives to God, it was coming from, look what I'm doing. And so it was just based on ego, and they were reinforcing that. So let's cast away fear of failure. Another reason that we give up, or not give up, but we let up, is the fear of the effort involved. Oh my God, what a massive job this is. What an incredible mess I am. You know, how can I ever... The amount of energy it's going to take for me to find God, I don't know that I've got it within me. But A dear friend of mine, I heard him say this in a class. He said, "You know, one lifetime isn't very much. And I've decided, however far I get, I'm giving this one lifetime to God. However far I get, that's a commitment I've made." And so we need to say, look at, instead of thinking, oh my God, it's going to get harder and harder, that isn't the truth. Remember, they say, at first difficult, and then effortlessly liberating. And we need to understand the more we put out on the spiritual path, the more energy we put out, the universe sustains us. And we are supported by forces that are cheering us on. We know the basic teachings: the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy, the greater the flow of energy, the greater the magnetism. And I don't know about you, but I have certainly experienced this in my life. Once I was going through a challenging period, and I decided, I'm going to do 108 kriyas morning and night till I get through this. And about for 1 year. That was my vow. And I had gone through about 9 months, everything was going smoothly, and then my mother, you know, it's never that simple. And I had to do some traveling, and I didn't get home till 3 a.m. And I was so exhausted, and I just flopped down into bed, closed my eyes. And I was just on the verge of sleep. And then it was as though a light went on in my brain. And I just sat up, and I thought, oh my gosh, I was so close. I was 9 months into this, and I almost didn't make it. And I sat up, and I did my kriyas. But I didn't do that. I know I didn't do that. I was in deep subconsciousness. But by the energy that had I'd put out, it supported that and sustained that. So again, let's cast aside one of the things that says it's too much energy. Do what you can, and God will make up the rest. That's why it says in the Gita, I will make good their gains and make up their deficits. It's not talking about bank accounts. It's talking about spiritual effort. Another reason we let up is the fear of loss of self, of ego. The ego is afraid. The ego, again, it's that familial warmth. I know this. I know who I am. I'm not sure who I'm going to become. Will that be a person I like? Will that be someone that kind of goes along with how my worldview? And so we hedge it. We don't want to change, you know, change me, but not yet. And so we don't make the effort to really do that. But if we can remember again from the Gita, when Arjuna said, I can't kill those people, they're my own self. And then Krishna goes into a long, one of the most beautiful passages in the Gita, and all, I shouldn't say in the Gita, it's so far beyond that, in all of world spiritual literature, where he said, the soul is that which cannot die. A sword cannot cut it, and fire cannot burn it. It goes on and on. And what he's saying is, those parts of ourselves that are limiting, they don't die, they just get transmuted into a higher expression of ourself. And that's why Christ said, really to the same point, I came to give you life and life more abundantly. I came to give you yourself, but more richly, more profoundly, more a heightened sense of who we are. So again, when we get to that point where we begin hedging our bets, I'm not so sure, I'm pretty good the way I am, even though we know we're not, if we're honest at all. But just to say, let me see what that abundant life is. Let me see what the expression of my soul is. And to break through the limiting thoughts. Another reason why we let up is the uncertainty of the goal. Samadhi, I've read about it. I've heard people talk about it. I don't know what it is. And so we're just, it's sort of like we're not sure where we're going. So how can we get the thrust to get there? But we need to understand that every step of the way is a step closer to the goal. So when we sit and meditate, what do you feel? Do you feel peace? Do you feel joy? Do you feel freedom? We all feel something. We wouldn't be here if we didn't feel something. And so use those as markers along the way. Samadhi isn't something other. It's just an extension of where I am right now. And to have the confidence that I'm moving in that direction already. And one day it will be there for me totally. And again, the with the thought of moving towards the goal, you know, the Winter Olympics just happened. And when you think about the hours and years it takes for those athletes to prepare for those Winter Olympics, do you think they all thought at the beginning, I'm going to win the gold medal? They just said, I like this. I like being up on the skis. I like whatever sport it happened to be. I like curling, which is hard to understand, but I guess people do. It was sort of bizarre. We were sitting in an airport, Darshana Jyotish and I, in Mexico City, watching the Olympics, watching them curling, and it was like, whoa, this is a disconnect. But at any rate, all of those athletes, they don't know they're going to get the gold medal, but they go for the gold. And that's what each of us need to do. We don't know that we're going to get there, but let's go for it. And the difference, Master said, is in any worldly pursuit, only one person gets the gold. On the spiritual path, we can all get the gold. We can all get there. And so again, it's not competitive. It's just, let's move towards the goal, even though we're not entirely sure what that goal may be. But our hearts know. Our hearts have had glimpses of it. We wouldn't be on the spiritual path if our hearts and souls had not had glimpses of what that goal is. Another thing that holds us back from giving it everything is forgetfulness. Master says, material entanglements, sweet and mysterious, make us forget who and what we really are. And so we forget. We look at the life, and especially those of us who have the good karma of living at Ananda Village or in another spiritual Ananda community, it's not so bad. It isn't like all, you know, as bad as it could be when we read about what's going on in the world at large. And so we can say, oh, this isn't so bad. This life isn't so bad. And then we forget. We forget what motivated us from the beginning of this incarnation to seek God and to seek the spiritual path. And I would suggest for each of us, in trying to remotivate yourself, try to remember. Remember what it was like when you first saw Master's picture, or when you first read autobiography of a yogi, or when you first began meditating, or when you first began realizing, you know, I don't think this world is going to make me happy. I think it's as simple as that. And then we forget. And we get caught up, and we start thinking it's not so bad. And we start thinking, oh, look, this is my life and my job and my friends and my family, whatever it might be. And we get lost in that world. Just like the story, I won't go into it entirely, but Narada, when he asked Krishna to teach him the nature of delusion. And he goes off in the village and he marries. And, you know, many of you know the story. I won't go into it now. But we forget. So let's prompt our memory. Why did I get on the path in the first place? Let me not forget that. I remember when I used to, we have a grown son, but he went to high school in town, and I would pick him up sometimes at the end of the day at high school, and I would see all the kids coming out, And it was a very good spiritual experience for me because I just thought, Lord, don't ever let me forget why I chose the spiritual path. I don't want to go to high school again. But remember, don't let it get foggy in your mind. Keep it keen. That's why, you know, the medieval monastics would wear hair shirts and mortify the flesh. I'm not suggesting that. But it was to keep that edge of remembering that motivates you, that this world, as it says in the Gita, is sukha dukkha dham, the world of alternating pain and pleasure. And remember that. And then finally, another thing that holds us back from totally committing our energy is a sense of unworthiness. I'm not good enough. Maybe those other people who've been at Ananda from the beginning, they're going to find God, but you know, the chances for me are not so good. When you look at Master's teachings over and over again, it's a clarion call for every one of us to pick up this path with everything we've got. The past lives of all men are dark with many stains, Sri Yukteswar said. All things in the future will improve if we're making the right spiritual effort now. And on and on. So we need to say, whatever I may have been in this life or another life, now I draw the line in the sand. I'm trying not to accrue any more new bad karma. I'm trying to move forward. And whatever the past may be, that does not define who I am. You know, there's an amusing story which I'll share. Some of you have heard it, but it's worth sharing and remembering. Some years ago, Dhritish and I were talking, and Swami had encouraged all of us to try to achieve the state of Jivan Mukta, freed while living in this lifetime. This was a few years ago. Things have changed dramatically since then. No, not really. But I was saying to Jyotish, you know, I don't think I'm of that caliber. I don't think I'm someone who could really work out all my karma in this life. And in his usual impersonal, objective way, he said, you better go for it, but have plan B. And now I'm trying to let plan B go and just say, I think I can do this. I think I can. And so these are all things that keep us from saying, that dull the motivation, dull the blade of our discrimination that says, this world is not where I will find my fulfillment. My fulfillment will be found only in God. And so then, what are a few points we can look at that really help us to be motivated in this search? First is looking at life with the sense of its brevity. Life goes by so quickly. We've been here, many of us, for 45 years on this spiritual path. Really, it seems like a few years. It doesn't seem like 45 years. Life goes by so quickly, and we need to look and say, I need to take this seriously. It's going to be over before I know it. And how much time have I wasted? And you say, well, next year I'm really going to put that effort into Kriya. Eventually, a whole life goes by, and Master says, why not now? So to look at the brevity of life and say, in the time that's left to me, I'm going to make a dash for the infinite. And don't think that we have all this time ahead of us, because honestly, friends, we don't. A few years ago, Swami had asked us to come to India and stay for some time. And we said, Swami, we're kind of arranging our life so that we're not so needed in other jobs. Other people are in place and we're free to do that. And he said, good. We should all live our lives in such a way that if we left tomorrow, nothing would be left undone. And that's an excellent way to live. Every day, when you get up from your meditation, or when you sit to meditate, just to think, this may be the last opportunity in this lifetime. Who knows what lies ahead? And that's why Master said the minutes are more important than the years. The years stretch out vaguely, but the minutes in meditation, the focus of energy and thought at the kutastha, that's what keeps us, frees us, and takes us out of whatever time is allotted to us, we can move forward. So a sense of timing, and then from that, what are the priorities we want to set in the time given to us? We need to look so carefully. Swamiji says it takes total self-honesty and dynamic self-discipline to grow spiritually. So let's not kid ourselves. Sometimes I get, it makes me sad when I talk to people and they say, well, I know I've got this problem, but, you know, it's okay, I don't need to deal with it. Why? Why don't you need to deal with it if it's a problem? We all need to be scrupulously self-honest. And if there are things about us that need to change, let's work on it in the time we've got, because we don't know how much time. So to work on, to set priorities, and as Swamiji said, to move towards, in this lifetime, becoming a Jivan Mukta, which means you've burned up all your past karma, you're freed while living. And why not set that as a goal? Maybe we won't make it, maybe we won't get the gold medal, but at least it's far worthier than just letting our energy go out into so many different wasted pastimes. Another thing, and I alluded to this when talking about the high school, that motivates us, the process of reincarnation. I read a quote from Master that said, reincarnation is motivated by a satanic force that fills us with desires and involvement with the world and keeps us coming back again and again. So it's not just, oh, well, you know, I'll play this out. The involvement and desires that catch us, it's a satanic force. It's like we can think that Maya has this great circus, and it's got so many tents and so many sideshows, and it's out there hawking, come to the circus, the most famous circus, and come and see this and that, and we go for it. We say, oh yeah, okay, maybe I'll come into the circus, and that looks really interesting. Oh, look at the elephant man, and you know, we get attracted by all the bizarre and the trivial activities of life. And we need to understand it's a conscious force that keeps the circus going and wants us to come in. If the barker at the circus said, you know, it's not so interesting, he'd probably have more fun going and meditating. That circus would fold. And the whole play of Maya would fold if there wasn't the satanic force that says, I think you're going to like this. And then we say, okay, well, I didn't do that last time, but maybe if I do it this way this time. And it goes on, and we never get rid of all the little burrs and thistles that stick to us. And that's why Swami said, every night before you go to sleep, create a bonfire, mental bonfire in your mind, and throw all of the activities, all of the pastimes, all of your reactions, all of your desires, throw it into that bonfire and go to sleep free. And then when you wake up in the morning, say, I awake into this world to do my God-given duty, but none of it is mine. And that's how we move towards freedom. And finally, the last strongly motivating point we can use is to magnetically attune ourselves to God and Guru, because ultimately, it's their power which changes us. A few years ago, we were in India with Swamiji, and he was giving a satsang, and he was doing questions and answers, and someone asked him, can you describe your path of sadhana? What is your sadhana? And he didn't pause for a second. He just said, my sadhana is guru bhakti. That was the first thing he said, devotion to the guru, guru seva, service to the guru, and meditation. And by doing those things, he said, I am free. And so to motivate ourselves, draw on the power of these great ones, that's why the guru has come. He didn't come to, as Lahiri didn't even want his picture. He didn't come that we would put his picture on the altar and worship him. They came because, as Lahiri Mahashaya said of Master, as an infant, your son will be a great spiritual engine that will bring many souls to God. And that's why they came. And if we want ever new motivation, if we want to renew our motivation, go to the source. Go to the source of inspiration. Go to the source of that power that draws us to God. If the circus barker is saying, come and look at all the multitudinal distractions, there's the guru who's saying, come home to the kingdom of God, and I will show you the way. So if we want to remotivate ourselves, renew our motivation to seek God, guru bhakti, guru seva, and meditation, and then we will be able to pick up every day on the spiritual path and say, today I will try even harder to become one with God.